Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Anat Benyel, creator of Anat Benyel Method Neuromovement and the best-selling author of two books, Move Into Life and Kids Beyond Limits. Her work is supported by leading neuroscientists and is the subject of the documentary A Life Unbound. World-renowned in the field of special needs, she and the nearly 1,000 practitioners that she has trained have used neuromovement to help adults and children heal from physical, emotional, and mental trauma. Thank you so much for joining us, Anat.
I'm pleased to be here with you, Megan.
So I would love it if you could start by telling me what got you interested in working with people who've experienced trauma.
Actually, I was not interested in people. I didn't conceptualize it as being interested in people that have had experience with trauma. I was just interested. I was in grad school. I had a background in studied statistics and psychology and went to become a psychotherapist, clinical psychology in grad school. So I was interested in people who had emotional issues, but I didn't have the concept of trauma in my mind, basically. And then as I, you know, did that, and then after the 73 war in Israel, I realized then that's when I got it. I got trauma in the sense of a whole population is in trauma and the neglect of attending to the trauma by the leaders. I mean, actually that was because I served in the army, but then I became a psychologist, worked as a psychologist for the Israeli army. So that was very clear to me then, but it wasn't a concept. And what I wanted to do is work with people through movement and through sensation, because the training in psychology is very lots and lots of words. And I was a dancer also.
Lots of thinking.
Yeah. And I wanted the immediacy of the sensation and the movement. And I was also always interested in the brain. Can't tell you where I got to that. But and it was long before people talked of the brain, about the brain or brain plasticity. And initially, I worked primarily with dancers, musicians, high performers, because that was my world. And then after a few years, the children with special needs came into my life. And that's when I got the distinction of trauma, both the trauma of whatever happened to them, like traumatic birth or accidents or mostly that kind of trauma, even though some issues are like genetic disorder or autism that are not any specific trauma that we're aware of. But then I started seeing that the parents are traumatized and I realized that there's nothing addressing that. And then I looked at the kind of interventions that were done with people. I also started working. I in the beginning, I was just like anybody who came to me, I worked with them because I was just fascinated with the work and I knew the brain matters and I knew how to use movement, you know, all that stuff. So stroke survivors, mega trauma. And because I had background in psychology, I realized it's not just the loss of the movement of the arm or the ability to speak. It's like today's Monday and Tuesday, you're not the person you were on Monday. You know, your life is like different in a very, very dramatic way. And then I started becoming more aware of how the interventions went. And that's when trauma became a real distinction for me. Because I realized that many of the interventions are trauma causing in their own right. So people are trying to help people really with the best of intentions, but they're unaware that the intervention causes trauma. And then I read the Trauma and Recovery, the book Trauma and Recovery. Have you ever read it? You know, that was like a classic beginning of kind of really putting sexual traumatization and war traumatization. It's just quite incredible. I had the good fortune to do a little bit of studying with her. And then it just kept evolving. And it wasn't until other people started talking about trauma that I had a path to put my ideas about trauma into. But my main path has always been the possibilities and opportunities through a positive driving interaction with the human brain. And obviously, when we want to recover with trauma, we really, really having to befriend the brain.
Absolutely.
So that's my story. Yeah.
I'm so glad I asked. It's a fascinating story. Gosh. And you kind of, you mentioned very quickly the neuroplasticity of the brain. And so I would love if you talked a little bit more about how your method, what your method is, and then how it integrates and understands the neuroplasticity of the brain and takes advantage of that and what we know about that now.
Okay. And feel free to ask me questions along the way, because I can just go, as I told you. So serve us to talk somewhere along the line of how we recover from trauma, you know, how trauma is inflicted, but then the process of recovery from trauma. And there's some magnificent people doing magnificent work in this field. My thought was that if we want to know how trauma happens, we need to know how successful growth and development happens, because trauma smacks that down at any level of life. It can be in utero, it can be shortly after birth, childhood, adulthood, anywhere along the line, we can smack the process, basically, right? We can traumatize the system. And it's really important to understand, first of all, that the brain manages and organizes movement and thought and feelings and all that stuff. And the baby, from conception on, it's a massive process of differentiation and integration. The differentiation of the cells, the separation to three layers of cells, you know, the formation of the nervous system, the formation of the, you know, the inner organs, everything, the growth of the bones, massive, 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 massive process of differentiation that then puts itself, integrates into forms that then can function. And the functionality is very, very dependent on the brain. The brain does that process probably more than any other individual organ, and continues doing it, or potentially can continue doing it throughout life, in the intensity that I believe it can be pretty close to the initial intensity of childhood. So the idea is that we learn to we're born with a lot of processes that are working, you know, the vegetative nervous system and all that stuff. But anything that we do as adults that associates with the voluntary system is formed. So it starts from not being there, and then there is, whatever, and it gets to the point that it's there. It gets to the point that the child can say, "Mama." It gets to the point that you can move your head like that and not lose balance. Right? I mean, everything, it's amazing. It's everything eventually is learned. And the learning requires a massive differentiation and support of that process. For this process to be successful, because we're going to be talking about trauma, the system has to have sufficient safety, both in reality, in the experience of itself. So by my understanding, the primary factor or mechanism that drives this process of growth is movement and the sensation that's associated with movement. And the formation of the sense of self, the formation of perception of space, the me versus not me, the identification, you know, creating visual constancy. That means that you look at the objects, and as they get further or closer, they don't change in size. That means that your world, you impose order. The brain imposes order on itself and on the outside world. And movement, you take away movement, the process is gone. I mean, if you really take away movement, we're dead.
Right, right. That's the definition of stillness, right?
Well, I don't know about stillness, but because when we sit still and meditate, we still have tons and tons of minute little movements and breathing going on and adjusting for balance. I mean, there's just, I mean, we're talking for quadrillion connections in the brain. I mean, this is huge. It's a massive system and so miraculous how it works. And it really is built to learn and to optimize itself. It's really built to do good. So if we give it the conditions to do well, it does better and better. In just throwing it in, trauma impacts everything and it impacts the brain. It literally impacts the structure of the brain. Our brain responds to our experiences all the time. It's not like, oh, if I go to class, my brain will wake up. Most of those changes and connections don't go anywhere to make anything new or different necessarily, but it can do that, you know. So the idea is, how can we drive the system intentionally to do the kind of successful processes that healthy children do to begin with? Because we have to heal, and the healing, there is, wherever there is injury, by my understanding, it's always a movement forward. Knowing what happened to oneself is extremely important. Creating a story that makes sense, validating it, and you know that, is incredibly important in the process. And what I bring in is the formation of the new, the creation of the new. There is somewhere else for you or for me or for the person, literally new possibilities, new ways of feeling, new ways of sensing, not different sensory system, but new experiences of strength, of power. I mean, I can say a brief story. There was a child that they actually, it's a non-practitioner, but anyway, he had an assistant working for him. She had a boy and he was about 6 years old, and his grandmother died, and he was very close to grandmother, and it was very hard. I wouldn't even say traumatizing, because it depends how the family handled it, but it was definitely very hard and very challenging. And his teacher in school, and he was in first grade, wasn't very comfortable with a crying child and a sad child. So at a certain point, and, you know, she told him that it's time to stop crying and he has to be a big boy, you know, whatever. And the child just caved in, also posturally. Anyway, so I was asked to see him, and I saw the boy, the sweetest little thing, delicate. He wasn't like a macho little boy. He was a delicate boy. And the way he stood, and that was probably there before the grandmother died, did not provide him with much power. And I don't mean just psychological. I mean, like, literally the sense, the feeling of power. The
physicality of space in the world, right.
You know, and it's very specific, but I'm not going to detail about that because that's not what we're talking about. And so I looked at the boy, and I said to the mother, the first thing you do is you change him into another class, because this teacher is traumatizing for your son. She's not a bad woman, but he's not the one that she should learn over his back. I said, just go and gently move him to another class. Find a good teacher. Find one that's more loving and, you know, accepting and embracing. And she did that, actually. And then I started working with the boy. And the way I work to get his whole, to bring to discover ways to move and stand and organize itself dynamically so he's powerful. And the whole trajectory of this boy's life changed, you know? And then there was, so it's always the movement forward. It's a sense of potency and power and freedom that comes from the process of a positive brain change, positive neuroplasticity. And so that's how I encapsulate my work in the context of trauma.
Yeah. And in the example that you gave, kind of what I'm hearing, and please correct me if I'm wrong or making assumptions, but that the grandmother, you know, a tight, close-knit relationship, His relationship with that teacher might have been fine until one of his like safe people in his life that gave him security and strength was missing. And then that plus having, an abrasive or not so nurturing teacher would make you kind of like collapse. Like your safe person, somebody that you nurture, has nurtured you, is gone. Your own kind of like personal way that you move in the world is just a little bit more sensitive or a little bit more meeker, maybe, if we're struggling for words to describe that type of, personality in the world. But by, changing what you can about the situation, first establishing like that new teacher establishes like, here is a safe, nurturing person. Like, we're going to change your environment to be of more a safety and nurturing so that your, nervous system can feel at home in this place. And then we're going to teach you how to actually embody space and how to move in a way and to carry yourself in a way and to feel the world around you in a way that is empowering, both literally and figuratively, as you're, thinking about it, like, I'm going to take up space and I'm going to have my feet on the ground and I'm going to, stand with my head held tall. I don't know what your instructions were to him specifically. I'd love it if you walk me through them. But is that kind of what I'm hearing from you?
Yeah, you're definitely hearing. I agree with you. I mean, that's one. These are a couple lenses that I want to just. One is, I'll call it layering. Trauma can be like one traumatic event, like one massive thing that happens. Or trauma can be layered. So it can be a host of circumstances that together make it so the system basically can't handle the excessive stressors.
Right.
And the recovery is also multi-dimensional, multi-directional, and layered. And there's some things that we need. It's absolutely, I believe, true across the board. The loss of a sense of safety, fundamental sense of safety, is an element, an important element. The loss of a sense of power and control is very, very important. And the another thing is the loss of connection or connectivity with the self and the other as a result, or as due to the circumstances. So I'll say two things here. The boy was suffering. The mother was very loving. There was no question.
Right.
But sometimes it's also a question of skill. But let's just talk about the classroom. So I don't have to make it too complex. And I'm sure you know that a huge part of trauma, or sort of like a trauma on top of the trauma or part of the layering, when the person that was traumatized is either not seen their horror, let's just call it that, or invalidated or ridiculed or turning them into the enemy because they endanger the traumatizer, right? So making you crazy or a liar or, but even if people are not doing anything actively negative or malevolent, maybe the most important elements in our life is to be seen, but seen not just with the eyes, seen with the heart, seen with the feeling, seen with the hearing, being validated and known. And over the years, and you asked me about that before, so I'll say a few words about it when it's time. One of the conclusions I arrived over many years of work and over work with children anywhere from age 5 days, to whatever we call a child, and then with adults all the way to their 90s. But mostly I got it with the kids, because the kids come with the parents and they come with the doctors that said this and the prognosis and the diagnosis, and they're little and they have to grow or they're not going to make it, right? They have to develop. And I saw how a child is born, and then and at some point between 0 to 5, let's say, or 7, usually, unless later on it's an accident or something, the whole system, the whole social system, the loving social system, all wants to fix the child. Mm. They want, so all of a sudden, and I'm going to say it, you know, it pretty kind of crude, in a crude way, all of a sudden the child has a job. The job is to get well and to satisfy the understandable needs and desires on behalf of the child, for the child to do well. And in the effort to fix the child, so many not great things can be done, because the moment we want to fix another, if I want to fix you, I disconnect from you. I believe these are two mutually exclusive, there's a word in mathematics.
No, mutually. I think you were on the right track. Mutually exclusive. Yeah. Once you try to fix someone. You're not seeing in them. Yeah.
Yeah. Because in order to help someone get new options, new possibilities, new for their brain to wake up and say, get all that richness of information with which it can invent the new in a context, like I can now use my hand that I couldn't because I lost X amount of part of my brain, right? Or emotionally, I now can relate to other people's blah, blah, blah. It's new. It's not going back to what was there before. There is no past to go to. And there's no really future to go to now. So we can only work now and connect now. And it took years, you know, because it's like I knew that what was done was not great, but it takes time to evolve and refine and make it accessible to myself and then later to other people. So I can talk about, I have 9 what I call essentials, that each one is a friend of the brain. I call it the brain vitamins. And what it really does, it creates conditions that wake up the brain and tend to get it to resume the process of self-formation, growth, and invention of itself. So a traumatized person, what happens to our identity, to the sense of self, really gets crushed. And it's not our true self, but it derails us from our normal path where we would have, you know, it's kind of like an exuberant child that all of a sudden something horrible happened and it's kind of like a dark cloud and all of a sudden the path of life completely changes.
Right.
So what can we do if we're not going to make somebody who can't do something or lost certain abilities or certain emotional universe? We can't make it be there. We can't force it to be there. So we have to provide conditions for it to form itself within the self spontaneously.
I definitely want you to name them. I want to pause just for a second to ask some kind of clarifying, because it's so interesting because you keep making a distinction between, you know, somebody who's had a trauma injury of more of an emotional or an environmental factor, and then somebody who's suffered something like a stroke or a brain trauma, right? And the way that we treat those two kind of different ends of the spectrum is so fascinating, isn't it? Because with somebody who's had a stroke or something, we give them the therapies and the tools for them to, and we train them how to retrain their brain. It's like, we're going to give them the therapies or the tools.
No, because a lot of the therapies and the rehabilitation, the classic way, you know, the traditional way is doing it, it impacts the brain, but it doesn't give the brain a very good opportunity to reform
new.
The lost functions. That's number one. This is where I come in and I say, oh my God, I mean, the way the therapy is done, it puts a ceiling of the how much people will actually get back or to a new level of functioning. By the way, this work is not just for traumatized people. I work with the schools, you know, in Canada with the school district, or, you know, it potentiates us. It potentiates our learning and potentiates, you know, builds, opens for many possibilities. Mm. But another big mistake is to think, oh, you had stroke, then we have to fix your arm because your arm is not. The emotional trauma is phenomenal. And it's the whole system is traumatized, but the brain always has to put order in the disorder and make sense out of the nonsense. That's basically the job of the brain. It's so when it loses a part of itself, it swells, but you know, things die, you know, cells die and so on. It still has to put order in the disorder and make sense out of the nonsense. And it's also true for somebody who was traumatized. So the question is, what kind of order will it do and what kind of sense will it make of the nonsense, the nonsense of the flow of information? So what are we providing to the person who needs to heal, or what are we providing for that brain, and what is the timing that we do it? I've worked with a few strokes adults, you know, men in their 60s or whatever they were, that one of them was 48 and a couple were in the early 60s. And they happened to have known about me before. So I got to start working with them within a couple, 3 days of the trauma, so with a stroke, and all of them got 100% functioning back, 100% functioning back. And, you know, it's kind of like it's unheard of in this level of, because I jumped in before the brain had time to rearrange itself around the existing present time situation. Mm-hmm. And I kind of gave it input, created conditions where it had something to work with rather than settle into what it's experiencing, because the brain learns its experience. It doesn't learn what we want it to learn. It learns what it is experiencing. And that's one of the things that is really understood by people like Peter Levine, or, you know, the wonderful people that we know are working on trauma. And it's really pretty absent of real understanding in the medical and rehabilitation world and the education or schools and stuff like that, not really understood. So we need to intentionally step in as quickly as we can and then provide the conditions that really support the brain to rebuild itself where it needs to.
As it's making sense in new ways of what's going on,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you know, a rape victim. I mean, we all know that people get raped, but to go through it, it's like, what, the, you know, the hour before and the minute after, it's like, how do you put yourself together again? And you will put yourself together again. But the question, how? And that's where we talk about trauma and recovery from trauma. That's where we have magnificent opportunities, because most people get traumatized. It just seems to be life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah. All right. So I do want to hear the 9 essentials for positive brain changes. Give it to me.
Okay. So just remember, my work is in the context of movement. Movement is movement is the language of the brain, and we can use it to communicate with the brain in really profitable ways. And I just want to make an umbrella statement that all of the essentials are supported and get more and more supported by current neuroscience research. In the application, I got to those principles not from doing lab work in neuroscience, but I extracted it from observing what I did and how it worked. So I said, what about what I do works? And I knew it's the brain, so I extracted the essentials from my observations and awareness of what I'm doing and the outcomes. And then I went to look if the neuroscientists have already realized it. And it was, you know, started about 20 years ago, and that's when all this magnificent research started coming. So it was so wonderful and liberating for me and validating. And also because I have scientific background, but I chose to go the clinical path. So other people are doing all the research work and they're amazing researchers out there. So the first one is movement, but not any. So any movement is great as long as not injurious, right? So it's better and it can help and so on. But to wake up the brain, to really get into massive self-building and invention and creation, it's movement with attention to the feeling of self as you move. So it's not so much this movement or that movement. It's as you move the in a sense, the purpose of the movement is to give you an opportunity to feel and sense yourself. That's what newborns do. You know, first they are just involuntary movement, but then, you know, they lie in the crib, you know, they do this. And they don't know yet it's their arm. They don't know it's their hand. This is like really interesting toy, you know, or thing. So, yeah. So movement with attention. So you can do it anywhere. You can do it when you, you know, make your coffee, or when you take your walk, or if you're going to exercise in the gym and you're going to weightlift and you do the movement of the weightlifting, either without weight, just the weight of your arms or your legs, and you feel and you pay attention to different parts of your body, because of course the brain has to organize the whole system all the time. So you do that. The changes are so rapid. We don't have time in this interview, but I do sometimes a, you know, 3, 4, 5 minute movement experience for people, and it's just like, wow. I mean, it's just like it's like magic. It's really powerful. I love it, and I keep being interested in doing it because I work with people. It's magic. I mean, I feel like you know, I'm cheating, because it's the changes happen so fast, and I do so, from my point of view, I do very little. Yeah. Now so with it, a really good essential to come is slow. So usually people try to do things fast to get good at doing them, but it's really reversing how the brain works. We slow down. There's time to feel, there's time to sense, there's time to become aware, and you give the brain time. And slowing down, I have gotten people to do things that they were practicing or trying to do for 10 years, 15 years, like martial artists, you know, people like that. And I just slow them down. And then I put a few of the other essentials in. And in 30 minutes, they are able to do something they have invested 10, 15 years. Musicians, I worked with, you know, orchestras and some of the world top musicians, classical musicians mostly. And working with musicians is amazing, because they are so used to differentiate. Their brain is a genius in differentiation, right? But in the area of the auditory area.
Right.
But I realized I get them to, and many of them are klutzes when it comes to movement. You know, they're not very good at the, you know, movement. They're busy, you know, protecting
themselves. Not very coordinated otherwise, right? Yeah.
No, I mean, it's not like they're not coordinated, but they're not like, you know, gym and lifting weights. I mean, they do, they spend, but they have this brain that is a really high level capacity to notice differences and get the information from that. So when I move it to movement with them, they just respond, not just getting rid, because they come to me with their, you know, shoulder or this, and I worked with some orchestras that had lots of musicians that had peers that they couldn't play and so on, because of repetitive movement injuries, is like what they call it, right? But when we do that, the pain goes away, which is a great thing, but the quality of the music just pops a few notches up. And I'm talking some of the, you know,
the best,
you would pay
yeah.
a lot of money to go to a concert, right? And here I am, little me, you know, but I happen to hear changes in the quality of the music, so I can use, and then once they feel it, it gives such powerful positive feedback to the system, to the brain, and emotionally, so, you know, all the right hormones and endorphins and everything comes up, they just change it, because they now play more the way they want to hear the music, you know, so it's a wonderful cycle. So movement with attention to the feeling of self, that's the main part there. Then a slow. The next one is subtlety. It all goes, it's kind of a group of things, reduction of force. The more intense the stimulus, the less we can perceive an addition or reduction in the amount of stimulation. The source of information for the brain is the perception of differences in the flow of stimulation. So, but when I say where does the brain get information, it's a hop in understanding. So people say stimulation. I say not yes, but insufficient. Necessary condition, insufficient. The brain, in a sense, generates the information. Without stimulation, it doesn't have anything to work with. And it drives the system crazy. You know, there are experiments in psychology they did many years ago where they try to clean out as much variability in stimulation as possible. And people, if you keep them long enough, they really go psychotic. The brain just loses, it can't anchor itself in anything. I mean, it's not a good thing. But but in the doing, so working with athletes or you know, top dancers, and all of them have certain limitations. One leg lifts higher than the other, or mm-hmm. I can shoot a ball and into the basket, you know, into the basket, you say, the hoop.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
I was translating from Hebrew, and it doesn't work necessarily. And I can do it from the right side, but when I go from the left side, I don't do as well. So that has to, but it we depend on noticing, and it's not necessarily conscious, most of it is subconscious, but that's what the brain works with. You know, it's kind of like information cookie monster, right? So very powerful way to help wake up the brain actually to very massive learning is to reduce the intensity. This is so counterintuitive because people feel like if I go faster and I go harder and I'm doing it right. and feel the pain and, you know, feel the burn and all this stuff. And the brain doesn't work like a mechanical system. More force doesn't give necessarily more outcomes. So it's really a request on us as humans to evolve, to go be above the more primitive, automatic, lower brain centers way of, you know, less differentiated, and allow and see how subtlety, I call this essential subtlety, is really potent for impacting the brain in a positive way. And of course, the brain is me. You know, if my brain is working well, I'm working well or better. So that's the third one. The fourth one is variation. And that's a very well-known one. And usually people, when they talk about variation or variability, they think, you know, I will do, I ride the bike and then I will take a singing lesson and then I'll do this and then I'll do that. Which is fine. It's perfectly fine. And it's definitely useful. There is another kind of variability that actually has, in my experience, the greatest potency for our own growth and healing. And that's doing the same thing in different ways. So a very quick, because what is variation? Variations are differences. So we have control intentionally bringing in the differences that the brain is going to notice. I had a musician, a world-class cellist, I mean, in one of the famous quartets. And he came to me because he could barely play anymore. He was in so much pain. And he had a very rigid training, and you could see it in the way he sat and so on. So it's amazing. He's a genius musician to play so well, given how he was trained. Let's put it this way. And there's something very traumatizing by its nature when you take a young living child and put a cello and restrict them powerfully to do it the right way. It's like fixing a game, right? And the brain is so brilliant that it manages to do it, but then the price is paid, the price is paid, the price is paid for the way we got to learn to do it. So, and I had only one session with him. I was traveling and I only had one session with him. It was in Germany. And so I didn't have time to do my usual longer process. And I think, okay, how can I make a difference for this man? And I asked him to take a really simple thing, which is like the twinkle, twinkle. It's a Bach, you know, twinkle, twinkle, little star. Yeah. And play to me for me. And he was like shocked. That was a big variation. I mean, he is like having concerts all over the world and asking to play this silly little thing. And I said to him, I asked him, I told him, I know you're a wonderful, wonderful musician, but if you don't mind, just for now. And he said, yes. And I said, could you please play badly for me? And he froze. Never in his life ever he tried to play something badly. And he just couldn't do it. And literally he was stopped. So I said, do you teach little children? He said, yes. I said, do they play badly sometimes? He said, yes. I said, can you remember one of them? I said, yes. I said, imitate. And I had him go one way, second way, third way, fourth way, the fifth way, he couldn't think of anything. I said, Four is enough.
And four I is said, good.
Yeah. And I said, now go play. And not only he was pain free, the quality, because I didn't play for, the same thing he played before. We did a baseline and then at the end. So the variations are very, very powerful. I use it all the time because variations, the human body and biologically, we generate variations all the time. People don't know that. It seems like it's the same. So variations is almost like breathing. Without variations, we wouldn't know what to do. So we can do it intentionally. The next one is enthusiasm. And enthusiasm in the sense of generosity of spirit, being able to notice fine changes in yourself or in the other, depends, you know, what we're talking like. So if I work with you and you come with a big thing like that, and you want that thing to either go away or be really different, and I work with you for 30, 45 minutes, and this thing is still kind of there, but it has something in it. The ability to notice it and to delight in it internally, to be delighted. I work with a large group of, you know, parents now online, and they call it the pot of gold. One pot of gold, another pot of gold. And we can only be in the here and now, and we all know that in meditation, but this is the practice of it, you know, in a different way. So it's not before, it's not after, it's now, and it's different. Oh my God, I have a brain. It changes. I'm doing a little bit better. I'm turning my head 1 degree better, or I'm not quite as upset, or I'm able to go and talk to the salesperson in the store, or I'm willing to have dinner with a friend. You know, and when we do that to ourselves or for someone else with whom we are interacting and supporting, the acceleration of outcomes is enormous. And of course, I learned that through the parents. Some parents got really delighted. And they weren't like, I don't allow anybody to clap hands or say good boy, because that means if they didn't do it, they were bad boys. You know, it's just internal. You know, it's just like yummy. You just delight in it. And the communication goes from brain to brain. We're just like, we're one brain. You and I right now are one brain for now, right? And then there is flexible goals. Goals are really good. They're important. People kill themselves trying to get the goal right away. Because I say to people, if you could, you would anyway. So it wouldn't be a goal. Mm. It'd be an intention. I have an intention to talk to you right now. But it's not a goal. So a goal, very important. It sort of organizes our direction in life. It gives us, you know, it's a good thing. However, it's how we go about it. And flexible goals are so important, because also for in the process of trying to achieve your goal, you allow many, many more, much more input to the system that could support you in figuring out how to do it or how to get there. Whereas if we put, you know, blinders, very often it's makes it we don't get there. Mm. So that's very, very important. And then there is imagination and dreams. Imagination is extremely powerful use of the brain. You know, I doubt that maybe other animals do it in a more rudimentary way, but the ability to play a whole piano sonata and practice it and play better afterwards, the ability to imagine is phenomenal. And I bring it into the work. And I use it directly in the movement stuff to imagine, really, every one of my essentials is a skill. So you get better at it. You do it, you get better. You do it, you get better. And you accelerate your brain's, you up your brain's potency. You literally get a better brain. And that's Michael Merzenich said that about my work. He's the guy who started, you know, the brain plasticity stuff. In the 80s, he said that this work, these essentials, help brain become stronger, better brains. Yeah, so that's, and dreams are, night dreams are fun, but, you know, dreams, we need a dream. To have a life, we need a dream. And it can be anything. It doesn't matter. It can be a garden in your backyard, or it can be going out to outer space. I don't have at all a dream to go to outer space. And I watch these people, you know, take 20 years and billions of dollars and enormous human intelligence to go out to outer space for initially, you know, 3 minutes or something. And I think it's magnificent. And of course, by inventing that, they invent a lot of other things on the way, and it can be very useful to humanity and so on and so forth. And the last one is awareness. Awareness is the crown. Awareness is a skill. For me, awareness is not a state of mind. It's a thing we do, and we can get better and better at it. So like all the you know, mythologies or stories about the top martial artists, or like if you watch Bruce Lee, you know, movie, he walks and somebody crawls behind him to hit him and he can feel it. You see, he senses it and he knows what to do and he turns around and it's perfect timing and it could be 17 people doing it and he can still do it. So it's remarkable awareness. Now, this is manifested, you know, in action, in movement like that. But awareness is the ability to know that I know, to know that I see, and so on and so forth. And I also say that awareness is the glue of learning. So when we do something that's new, one of the ways to not have to go back through the process again and again and repeat it a million times is if we really take a minute or two or three to really just become aware of different aspects of it, not trying to save it, not getting all cringed up. And all those nine essentials and shifting from the idea of fixing to connecting is a magnificent way, in my experience, of people to shed the trauma. You don't erase it, but it's almost like you grow out of it and you move to a different place. Now, under really severe conditions, we may regress to it. The brain does not lose what it had. It can always regress to earlier configurations, but the more and the fuller and the longer, it will take more and more real abusive stresses to push us back, but also then it's easier to come back out. So it's very important. Part of the, in my understanding, part of the important part of healing is not just moving out of the pain and the difficulty, but being willing to go back there intentionally, experience it for, you know, 10, 15 seconds, and then get back to the new place. Then we get the bridge and we have a say in the bridge. That's it.
It's fantastic. And it's fascinating to me that kind of awareness being the last step, because going back to what you said earlier about some of the ways that we can feel trauma and the manifestation of that being not seen, and going from fixing to connecting, and especially in yourself, all of these steps I can see enabling you to have some agency around going from trying to fix yourself or fix anybody else in order to get into connecting, trying to understand what that experience was communicating to you in your brain, and then changing what that communication is so that you can then have a sense of kind of autonomous seenness. I just made up a word, but we're going to go.
Sounds perfect. I'm adopting you.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I love every aspect of that, and especially the parts where we're slowing down. And I mean, how many of us could just benefit from slowing down?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Okay. So we have a website, AnatBanielMethod.com. I have a podcast. I stopped doing it during the pandemic, but we have close to 40,
episodes that are already up.
Mm-hmm. Episodes. And there I go, I've had episodes, you know, on each essential, and I've had guests like Giobotti Taylor and other wonderful, Rick Hansen, wonderful, who happen to be also friends and you know, colleagues. But so the podcast can be a great source of information. YouTube, it's under Anat Baniel. It's a channel. There's lots and lots of videos, short videos of work. Most of it is children, but also a little bit adults. And I have the two books, you know, Moving to Life, you know, The Nine Essentials for Lifelong Vitality. And the other one is Kids Beyond Limits, that is about the children. And on the website, I'm going to be doing, starting next year, public workshops online, you know, movement, neuro-movement workshops. And also, if people just sign up for the newsletter, you know, we have in November, December, I don't remember, but soon we're going to have, because I have other people taking care of that, but a healing fest with learning strategies where we're going to, for a week, people are going to get a 5-day workshop for that they can try for free, do it for free, vitality, anti-aging, and well-being. And in any, and so there's a lot of movement lessons. There are lectures, there's some experiential stuff. Mike Merzenich was there and gave, you know, talked to the group for an hour and so on. And it really can be transformational. So
I can see how it would be. And what you're, you know, what you've outlined, obviously I'm super interested in getting more engaged in myself, but it also is, it feels very accessible, right? These are not, your application of them and the way that you take people through them is what we would come to you for, but it's such an accessible model, yeah, and approachable.
Oh, and I have, I forgot to mention, I have programs. I have a whole body brain fitness program. It's 24 movement lessons focusing on breathing, sitting, balance, and general get your whole body in yourself kind of thing. And I have, you know, back pain, and I have scoliosis. I have advanced balance for people who do more advanced stuff. And it's pretty, people who do the work, it's gradual, but as you evolve more and more, your skillfulness and your complexity, the ability to do complex stuff, we do very, very athletic, almost acrobatic movement lessons, but we don't start with acrobatic. We start with people where they are, not where they wish they were.
Well, and it's always fascinating to me too, to find people that are very fit and then ask them to do a simple balance exercise and see how fit they are and how connected they are in their space in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, because remember, it's all differentiation and the refinement. And so it's the kind, if you have just chunky blocks to build with, you can't build a very elaborate structure. But if you differentiate, you can build this or that or this or that. I mean, there's a lot of freedom. Really, for me, part of what I love about this work, my work, is the sense of freedom. It's just so much freedom. It's freedom in thought. It's cognitive freedom. It's more and more emotional. The emotional one tends to be trickier because, you know, the emotional one, like, boom, it hijacks us so powerfully. But it's still, the successful therapy is a process of massive emotional differentiation and integration.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Anat Vanyal, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Megan. You are delightful, and I had a wonderful time with you, and thank you for the opportunity.